This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we are not just dusting off some old files. We are taking a digital pickaxe to one of the deepest, most restricted vaults of the Cold War.
We really are. This is material so sensitive that its official status is, and I'm quoting here, does not exist.
Right. So what we've done is assemble a pretty comprehensive stack of notes, index entries, and, you know, other source materials that detail a project. A project that started with these huge strategic ambitions and just ended in, well, catastrophic failure.
Total system failure.
Yeah.
This is really where you see that intersection of state-level paranoia, a budget with basically no limits, and a complete and total vacuum of ethical oversight.
So our mission today is to navigate these ghost files. We want to trace the creation and ultimately the self-liberation of what the documents themselves call living weapons.
We're going to unpack Operation Blossom. It was a 1958 initiative, and it resulted in something far more volatile and frankly much harder to contain than any nuclear device they were building at the time.
And we have to get this out of the way right up front, because there's this cultural callback in the notes that is, it's genuinely startling when you first read it.
It really is.
There's a phrase that just keeps appearing, probably drawn by analysts trying to process something they saw as impossible, and it really sets the stage. It says, "These were the real-life Powerpuff Girls, and their story is truly terrifying."
And that analogy, you know, as simple as it sounds, it's actually crucial. It gives you immediate context for the specialized nature of these subjects.
That's not about being cute or funny.
Not at all. It's about recognizing a perfectly complementary tactical unit, three young, genetically modified individuals. So our deep dive today is to get past that pop culture label and really understand the scientific and security horror that Operation Blossom represents.
We're going to trace the events from the very beginning, the facility in Nevada in 58, through the decades of failure, the successful creation, and then finally, that stunningly coordinated escape of the three subjects, Emily, Rose, and June.
And for you listening, we're drawing this from a few key sources. We have the episode companion source Operation Blossom, a detailed analysis called the U.S. Experiment that created real-life Powerpuff Girls, and some proprietary index notes from Ad Inspector Story.
Which really help contextualize how and why a government would go to such extreme lengths to just erase something from history. So, for our discussion, we are treating all of this compiled material as the factual surviving record of what happened.
Okay, so where do we start? The mindset.
Exactly. Let's establish that psychological backdrop. It's 1958. Why then? Why, at that specific point in the Cold War, would the U.S. government commit to something so wildly extreme as, and this is their term, rewriting human DNA?
Right. It's not just making a faster runner or a stronger soldier.
No, this is changing the human blueprint, fundamentally.
Well, by 1958, the context was one of just accelerating existential terror. The Soviet launch of Sputnik, that was late 57, and it had completely shattered American scientific and military complacency.
The game had changed overnight.
Totally. It wasn't just a nuclear arms race anymore. Suddenly, there was a missile gap, a technology gap. There was this deepening fear that the U.S. was losing its edge across the board. So the old response, you know, build more tanks, build more bombs, it felt insufficient.
So they needed something that couldn't be countered, a leap forward.
A transformative, game-changing advantage. They weren't just looking for an equalizer. It sounds like they were desperate for a deterrent so unique, so alien, that it would force the Soviets to just rethink their entire strategy.
Blindsight them.
Exactly. The sources confirm this. The project was born from a philosophy of tactical superiority that went beyond physics and into biology. If your enemy is looking at missile silos and tank divisions, you hit them with a biological capability they can't even categorize, let alone defend against.
They weren't trying to build highly trained operators.
Oh.
They were engineering a completely new form of organic weapon system.
And to do something like that, you need absolute secrecy. You need total isolation.
Precisely. The fact that they established Operation Blossom in 1958, deep in a remote Nevada desert facility, that tells you everything. The remoteness wasn't just to keep out prying eyes. It was a containment strategy.
They knew it could go wrong.
They expected it to go wrong. The government knew that if they actually succeeded in creating these living weapons, the risk of an accidental or, you know, a deliberate release was immense. So the remote location ensured that if the containment protocols failed, the initial blast zone, so to speak, would just be vast, empty desert.
Minimizing civilian casualties and exposure, it's the classic Cold War laboratory model.
It is. The government basically calculated that, what, dozens, maybe hundreds of square miles of unforgiving terrain were a fair trade for the chance at one single breakthrough that could win the arms race.
And it wasn't just about isolating the test subjects, was it? It was about isolating the secret itself.
That was the foundation. The mission goal, creating human beings with engineered destructive capabilities, that was a monumental transgression. If that got out, it could have shattered global confidence in the U.S. government overnight. Secrecy wasn't just a preference, it was everything.
Okay, so let's get into the project itself. Let's unpack the figure at the absolute center of this, Dr. Clyde Peeple. The source material is a bit sparse on his personal life, but the description is sharp. He's referred to as a strange scientist.
Yeah, and when you see a phrase like that in classified government files, it's almost never a compliment.
Right, it's a euphemism.
It's code. Mm-hmm. It's code for someone whose methods are unorthodox, probably illegal, definitely not repeatable in public. For a scientist to be put in charge of rewriting human DNA, they have to have a psychological profile that just, it subordinates conventional morality entirely to the mission.
They have to be able to dehumanize their subjects completely.
100%. You aren't picking a cautious academic who's worried about safety checks. You're picking someone who sees the subjects, even if they're children, as raw material for an experiment.
And the objective was so far out there for the time, creating living weapons by rewriting human DNA.
The technical leap there is what's critical. We're talking about the late 1950s. Genetics was, I mean, a rudimentary field.
Yeah.
This suggests Dr. Peeble was trying modifications that went way beyond, you know, simple gene therapy or enhancement.
So not just making muscle stronger.
No. The implication is that he was tampering with fundamental chromosomal structures or maybe introducing synthetic biological components to drive these very specific targeted superhuman functions. He was engineering entirely new metabolic or neural pathways.
And that terrifying goal came at a devastating cost. The files use the phrase, years of failed trials.
And we don't have a body count, but the length and difficulty implied by that phrase. It suggests a really tragic history.
So what does that tell us? The length of the trials.
It tells us two things. First, the science was brutally, brutally difficult. They were trying something revolutionary, probably working entirely by trial and error. And second, it highlights the program's ruthless dedication.
The fact that Emily, Rose, and June even exist is proof of that.
It's confirmation that Operation Blossom saw human life, or at least the lives of its test subjects, as completely expendable. Every failure, every subject who didn't survive the process was just data. It was just confirmation that they needed to keep going until they got a viable result.
It implies a hidden graveyard out there in the Nevada desert, a monument to the lines they were willing to cross again and again.
And that's the defining feature of these Cold War Black projects. The ethical disposal of failure was just a line item in the budget. And the very identity of Dr. Peeble, this strange scientist, is tied to that willingness to sacrifice. He was the only person ruthless enough, or maybe unburdened enough by empathy, to see the mission through.
So after years of this horrific process, he does it. He succeeds. He creates the three genetically modified girls. And this is the moment the project shifts from a terrifying ambition to a contained, devastating reality.
And the moment of success immediately defines their entire existence. The source materials are unambiguous on this. They were never given a childhood.
Treated like weapons, not children. That's the quote.
Exactly. Their identity, their environment, their relationship with the staff. Everything was defined by their tactical potential, not their humanity. They weren't patients or even really prisoners in the traditional sense. They were kinetic assets waiting for deployment.
Which meant they needed an extreme system of control. The documents put a lot of emphasis on the key failsafe, these metal collars that could shut their abilities down instantly.
We have to analyze that mechanism because it tells you everything about the staff's fear.
It's not just a leash.
No, it's way more sophisticated. The ability to shut their abilities down instantly implies a highly advanced piece of tech. Maybe focused electromagnetic pulses to disrupt the unique neural pathways that channeled their powers.
Or something chemical.
Or maybe microvibrational frequencies targeting specific chemical agents that people engineered into their biology. We don't know the specifics, but the result was the same.
So if Emily was about to lift a pank, one button press would instantly incapacitate the specific biological function that let her do that.
Right. It's instant physical submission enforced by technology.
Yeah.
And it underscores just how fragile the whole containment operation was. The staff lived in perpetual immediate fear. They knew they needed an instantaneous kill switch because conventional restraints, a steel cell, that's meaningless against Emily's strength.
Or Rose's control over the locks.
Or June's mental dominance. The collars were the physical manifestation of the control narrative. We built you, and we can turn you off.
And their daily life was just a pressure cooker. The files say they were kept in isolation and tested endlessly.
Let's think about that isolation. It wasn't just being in a remote building. The files suggest it was severe sensory deprivation.
To keep them from forming bonds.
Or understanding the world outside the facility's walls. Their entire reality was the sterile, frightening environment of the lab.
Yeah.
And the endless testing. What does that even look like?
I imagine it would be a constant escalation, pushing their powers to the absolute limit.
Exactly. For Emily, maybe they're testing the tensile strength of new alloys against her blows. For Rose, the complexity of systems she could manipulate. Can she just do locks? Can she do the main power grid?
This wasn't training.
No, it was engineering quality control. By constantly forcing them to use and refine their destructive capabilities, the staff was ironically perfecting the very weapons they were terrified of.
It's the ultimate paradox.
It is. The system designed to contain them was also the very thing that made them effective enough to eventually escape it.
Okay, let's dedicate a moment to breaking down this trio. As you said, the sources point to them being a complementary tactical unit. This wasn't an accident, was it? They seemed designed to work in sync.
Oh, absolutely not an accident. The genius of Operation Blossom, if you can call it that, was recognizing that a single super soldier is inherently vulnerable. They have a weak spot. But a tactical team of three, each specializing in a different vector of attack or defense, that's a threat multiplier.
So they designed a force that could defeat physical structure, technological infrastructure, and human resistance.
All at the same time. Let's start with Emily. She's the physical vanguard.
The brute force.
Brute force, but with a degree of control. Her ability is described as superhuman, brutal strength. The sources use really vivid language, like lifting weights and tearing through materials no child should.
So we're talking about strength that just ignores conventional fortifications.
Exactly. She is the breach mechanism. In a hostile environment, Emily's role is to neutralize all structural barriers. Concrete, steel, layered titanium instantly. Yes. She doesn't need keys. She doesn't need codes or explosives. She just walks through the wall.
So she creates the path. Then you have Rose, who clears the path.
Right. Rose targets the system. She's the electronic countermeasure. Her ability is fascinatingly precise. She can interface with and control machinery with her mind.
So not just moving objects, it's specific to technology.
It's sophisticated psychokinesis applied exclusively to complex systems. She's the master of electronic warfare. She can flip switches, override security protocols, shut down mainframes, and neutralize automated defenses without ever touching a terminal.
So if Emily is breaking down the door, Rose is making sure the automated sentry guns on the other side don't fire.
She's making sure the alarms don't go off, the cameras go dark, and the lockdown protocols work for them, not against them.
Yeah.
She renders the opposition blind and inert.
But the truly frightening element, the one the files say broke the psychological state of the staff, that was June, the element of command.
June is the ultimate psychological weapon.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you.
Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Her ability is pure mind control, and the sources explicitly state it was so powerful that even the other scientists were afraid of her.
And why was that? Why was she scarier than the girl who could punch through a bunker?
Because the fear of Emily, or Rose, was quantifiable. You could, in theory, build a stronger wall or thicker shielding. But June's power, it subverts the very foundation of defense, the will of the human operator. She can bypass training, loyalty, and even immediate self-preservation instincts.
So in a military context, Emily handles the physical siege.
Rose handles the electronic counter siege.
And June handles the command structure and the personnel, neutralizing resistance before it even happens.
It's a perfect synthesis. And we have to consider their coordination. Was it just training or was it something more? The evidence suggests both. Dr. Peeple, in his relentless testing, he must have observed and exploited this synchronicity.
But the escape suggests something more instinctual.
It does. It suggests an inherent, almost telepathic connection that transcends training. It makes them incredibly unpredictable and, well, incredibly effective.
Yeah.
The coordination itself became a weapon. They didn't just have powerful abilities. They had the perfect combination of skills to dismantle the exact type of high-security facility that was holding them.
Which brings us to the escape. This is the moment the whole narrative pivots, and it really confirms that June, the mental weapon, was the true strategic commander of this group.
It really is a chilling testament to her mastery over her own abilities and her understanding of human weakness. The facility could withstand a physical assault, but it couldn't withstand an internal psychological manipulation.
And it all happens during a standard experiment.
A routine procedure. June secretly used her mind control on Dr. Peeple, just subtly.
And the documents say the control was so seamless that Peeple didn't show any outward signs. He just acted carelessly. He puts the collar remote, the one non-negotiable key to their containment, somewhere the girls could get it.
Under the table where the girls later find it. Let's just sit with the implications of that for a second. This wasn't a mistake. It wasn't a lapse in judgment. It was a deliberate, programmed act enabled by June's influence.
Dr. Peeple, the architect of their prison, was forced to sabotage his own security system without even knowing it.
He became an unwitting tool for his own creations. This is deep-level behavioral programming. This isn't just a simple suggestion like, you're getting sleepy. This is rewriting his immediate intentions.
It bypasses every security protocol, every layer of concrete, every armed guard. The vulnerability wasn't the metal door, it was the mind of the man in charge.
Exactly. This one act just fundamentally undermines the entire premise of Cold War security. They spent millions on infrastructure, on isolation, but they failed to protect the single most important asset, the control mechanism. June proved that the ultimate safeguard, the human operator, was also the most easily compromised.
She won the strategic victory before the first punch was even thrown.
The psychological horror for Peeple, if he ever realized it, must have been immense. To know your own consciousness betrayed you.
It makes you wonder if she'd been practicing on Peeple for months or even years, just subtly mapping the facility's weak points, preparing the ground for this one calculated moment.
It's entirely possible.
So that night, they get the remote. They disable the collars, and the facility becomes a theater of chaos. The source material says all hell broke loose. But the actions they describe, this wasn't panic.
Not at all. It was a perfectly timed, coordinated sequence of total systems destruction. It was a declaration of war executed with flawless efficiency. Their mission was survival, and that meant not just escaping, but neutralizing any immediate counter response.
So phase one, breaching confinement, drawing all the attention, Emily's role.
Emily, the unstoppable force, activates immediately. She breaks through walls and reinforced doors. Her actions are loud, aggressive, highly visible. It's the perfect distraction. Imagine the seismic shock inside that facility, reinforced concrete and steel just collapsing. The staff's immediate reaction would be focused entirely on containing that physical breach.
And while everyone is scrambling to deal with Emily's destruction, Rose is executing phase two.
Internal neutralization and tactical slowing. Rose goes for the command and control systems. She kills the alarms, which is brilliant. It ensures the breach isn't immediately transmitted to the outside world, buying them critical time.
And then she turns the facility's own defenses against them.
Yes, she locks down exits to trap their pursuers. She uses the magnetic locks, the pressure doors, everything to seal off sections, trapping their response teams or forcing them down dead ends. She turns their prison into a labyrinth that's optimized for their escape.
And then phase three, the clean passage, neutralizing the armed opposition with June's terrifying silent command.
June handles the personnel. Absolute operational silence. She freezes guards mid-step, forcing them to stand aside without firing a shot. This is the most crucial detail.
They didn't have to fight their way out.
No messy, lethal battle. They achieved non-lethal, frictionless passage past armed soldiers. It minimizes risk. It ensures speed. And can you imagine being another guard, seeing your colleagues just frozen in place? It's a psychological nightmare. Total loss of control.
The aftermath described in the documents is stark. The facility was left trashed in ruins, a complete write-off. And the three girls, they vanished into the desert night.
It wasn't just a prison break. It was a total tactical victory and a complete system failure. They achieved structural destruction, technological paralysis, and human neutralization all at once.
Wow.
They didn't just escape the cage. They guaranteed the cage itself couldn't be used against them in the immediate future.
They destroyed the source of their captivity and achieved complete autonomy.
Which brings us to the government's response. They wake up to a colossal multi-million dollar smoking hole in the Nevada desert, and their most prized high-risk assets are gone.
The immediate consequence, you'd expect, was a massive search.
A massive, desperate search operation that yielded absolutely nothing. The sources are clear. The girls were never recovered.
And when a search like that fails,
it mandates the inevitable second stage, official systemic denial. Reports detailing Operation Blossom, the years of failed trials, the escape, they were all meticulously buried. Operation Blossom was systematically erased from official history. Officially, legally, it doesn't exist.
And this connects back to that recurring theme we see in so many of these deep dives into the Black Files. We've talked about figures like Klaus Richter before.
Right, and that context is vital here. For you listening, when we talk about Klaus Richter, we're referencing a former subject whose entire service record, his very existence, was digitally and physically scrubbed. It shows that records can be erased to bury inconvenient truths. And the principle here is the same. Like Klaus Richter, erasure becomes the evidence.
The cover-up is the proof.
When a government executes such a comprehensive scrub-burning paper trails, liquidating the personnel records, reclassifying the entire facility as, I don't know, a geological survey post, It confirms the magnitude of what they're hiding.
And there's that other idea from our notes on the real Wendy file about identity suppression. Records can freeze while lives keep moving. That feels perfectly applicable here.
It's exactly what happened. The government's official timeline ends abruptly in 1958 with the denial. The story freezes. But the lives of Emily, Rose, and June, they continued. Outside the facility, carrying their profound, unique genetic modifications out into the civilian world, completely undetected.
So the government successfully contained the story.
But failed entirely to contain the subjects. And that systemic failure must have caused just intense internal panic. They didn't just fail to contain the weapons. They failed to contain the information because the subjects themselves are now walking, breathing, active pieces of classified intelligence.
You have to think about the psychological impact on the staff who were there, who saw it happen.
Oh, absolutely. Those who witnessed this synchronized, flawless destruction of the facility by three young girls and were then told, you have to forget it, it didn't happen. That is a unique kind of trauma. They saw their deepest fears realized, and then their government demanded they deny reality.
It's institutional gaslighting on a massive scale.
Exactly. The official denial isn't just a lie to the public. It's a form of psychological control over the witnesses themselves.
Which leads us to maybe the most cryptic, but also the most provocative detail in the surviving documents. Years after the official erasure, some scattered lines that somehow survived the scrub turn up in declassified files.
Thank you, Fragment.
And they mention sightings of three pregnant women near abandoned military installations in the Southwest.
This tiny, seemingly innocuous detail, it shifts the entire story. It goes from an escape narrative to a lineage narrative. Why mention pregnancy?
It redefines them. They're no longer weapons objects of destruction. They're creators, authors of a new uncontrolled generation.
They weren't just seeking personal freedom. They were securing their continuation. And this introduces the profound implication of generational inheritance. If their unique Genetically engineered DNA is transmissible.
Then the government didn't just lose three weapons.
They potentially seeded the civilian landscape with an entirely new, uncontrolled line of superpowered individuals. This is the ultimate catastrophic backfire of Operation Blossom. They intended to create a tool of strategic superiority, and instead they may have initiated an entirely new hidden dynasty completely outside their jurisdiction.
And the detail about the sightings being near abandoned military installations, that feels significant.
It's highly suggestive. Was it a conscious choice? Maybe they were drawn back to the environments of their creation, subconsciously seeking resources or shelter in places the civilian world avoids.
Or just mapping the territory they were once meant to conquer for the government.
Could be. But the records are clear. They disappeared as quickly as they appeared. They've maintained that stealth and autonomy they perfected during the escape. They have mastered the art of existing outside the surveillance grid.
And this transforms the whole incident from a historical footnote into a contemporary ongoing security risk.
That's the ultimate so what of it all. It's encapsulated in that question from the source files. Unofficially, the question remains, what happens when weapons built to protect a country decide to build lives of their own?
They transcended their programming. They chose autonomy, self-determination, and crucially, creation. It proves that their true power wasn't just physical or mental, it was existential.
They demonstrated that the ambition to create the perfect weapon also instilled the ultimate desire, freedom, and the capacity to leave a legacy entirely outside the control of their creators. The Cold War experiment in total control resulted in radical hidden freedom.
And it ensures that the threat, from their perspective, lives on.
So, to synthesize this whole profound and, frankly, terrifying history, Operation Blossom was the ultimate Cold War gamble.
Started in 58, trying to achieve genetic supremacy under the command of the amoral Dr. Clyde people.
It succeeded, creating Emily, Rose, and June, a perfectly coordinated living weapon system held captive by fragile technological restraints. And through June's strategic mental manipulation, the trio executed a total systems victory, dismantled the facility, and just vanished into the erasure of official history.
And the government buried it completely. But the fragmented records confirm not just their existence, but their continued freedom. Those sightings of the pregnant women years later, they suggest that Operation Blossom's greatest failure wasn't the destruction of its facility.
No. It was the successful initiation of a new, powerful, and completely uncontrolled lineage that now operates entirely outside the boundaries of state power. It's a powerful lesson in the futility of absolute control, especially when you're dealing with engineered consciousness.
The official history insists nothing happened.
But the reality is that the most catastrophic failures often persist the longest, just beyond the edge of the official narrative.
So here's the final provocative thought we want to leave you with, and this is straight from the source notes we analyzed today. Some cartoons about superpowered girls might feel less cute once you see what kind of experiments they could have been based on.
It really makes you think about how the sheer horror of a classified tragic reality can be sanitized, compressed, and softened into these popular, easily digestible myths.
What other buried histories are hiding out there in plain sight?
If you want the full breakdown and more erased stories just like this one, from the classified history of Klaus Richter to the profound identity suppression in the real Wendy file, you should head over to @InspectorStory.
Stay curious, question the official record, and remember that deep knowledge is the only true power that can never be shut down.
Not even with a metal collar.
We'll see you on the next deep dive.